Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer and historian Robert Morrison. He is the Queen's National Scholar at Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, and we're talking about his latest book, The Regency Years, during which Jane Austen writes, Napoleon fights, Byron makes love, and Britain becomes modern. Rob, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much. I'm thrilled to be here.
This is, for the benefit of the audience, this is the best kind of history book. This is the kind of history book that really gives you a sense of what life was like at that time period. And I want to thank you for doing all the research. But the amazing thing for me about the Regency is it's a very short time period.
Yes, it's under a decade.
Amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. I sort of was interested in it for a whole bunch of reasons, but one of them is just the brevity of it. And when I realized that Wellington defeated Napoleon and Jane Austen published all six of her novels in that period, and Charles Babbage thought of the modern computer, and Percy Shelley wrote his poetry, and Mary Shelley produced Frankenstein, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and that it all happened within this decade, I thought, people have talked about the Regency lots and lots, but one of the things I tried to do was sort of complicate what we think about the period, and I tried to range around enough that it ended up, I hope, presenting it in ways that people haven't thought about.
And it's for a history book, it's amazingly entertaining. It's really fascinating, but there's so much crammed in there. But we need to address what the Regency was. I mean, King George III. Is really not doing well. I'll let you take it from there.
All right. Well, King George III comes to the throne in 1760, and he has, he loses the war against America, and the French Revolution breaks out, and Britain, of course, ultimately defeats Napoleon at Waterloo in 1815. But George III is a very committed monarch and a pretty boring guy, and he has a dissolute son who's also named George. And in 1788, there's what's called the Regency Crisis. This is long before the Regency period, 1788. And his son thinks, oh, this is very good. He has a terrible relationship with his father, and he thinks, this is fantastic. He's going to lose his senses, and I'm going to become the most powerful man in Britain. And then George III, as we know, recovers and stays, reasonably strong mentally until his youngest daughter, Amelia, his favorite daughter, Amelia, dies. And he doesn't recover from this. This is a blow he doesn't recover from. And in 1810, he's sort of cast into darkness and spends his final decade in Windsor Castle in a straitjacket and having, pretty dark visions. And so his son, the Prince of Wales, becomes the Prince Regent. So I always think of it like this: if Elizabeth II, the current monarch, if something, heaven forbid, but if something happened, if she developed some sort of illness and was unable to govern or to be the figurehead, then Prince Charles, the current Prince Charles, would become the Prince Regent, and we would go into another regency. Historically, it usually happened when the king was only 16 months old or something. So George, who becomes George the Fourth, takes over, and he takes over from February 5th, 1811, until his father dies on January 29th, 1820, whereupon the person who was the Prince of Wales and became the Prince Regent becomes George the Fourth.
Let's talk about the character of the Prince Regent. Yeah. Okay, because one of the things that people will take away from your book are these incredible satirical cartoons by George Cruikshank.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Prince of Wales one as one I think of.
Yeah.
And people described him as rather too fond of wine and women.
Yeah.
He doesn't come off so well from a lot of the people who were alive at that time.
No. Jane Austen said, I hate him.
Yeah, can you imagine that? Jane Austen just writing, I hate you.
Yeah, I know. It's wonderful. That's the Jane Austen that I really, really am interested in, and the Jane Austen that I tried to bring out in this.
Yeah.
This book, the thing about there are things about the Regent's character that are absolutely unforgivable. His excesses in wine and his excesses in opium and his excesses in women and his treachery and his unwillingness to keep to his word and his willingness to spend.
Is there a positive thing? Is there something positive coming at the end of this?
Yes, there is. His willingness to spend vast sums of money when people are, you know, in London are starving. But his character, in my eyes, is at least partially redeemed by his cultural awareness of, for example, J.M.W. Turner.
Mm-hmm.
The Prince Regent knows that Jane Austen is a significant novelist in Austen's lifetime. Not everybody knows that. And he has her, he sort of, through his people, he leans on her to get her to dedicate Emma to him. And so if you open Emma, the first thing you see is Austen dedicating it to the Prince Regent, even though she hated him for how he treated his wife. So I would say that his character is partially redeemed by his aesthetic, artistic, and cultural judgments. One of the reasons the arts flourish in this period as never before, and I think never since, is because the monarch, the Prince Regent, puts his considerable weight behind painting, theater, novels, all those things. And he gives it a sort of an energy that I think it otherwise would not have had. So, you know, he's reprehensible in all kinds of ways. But his aesthetic judgments, you know, he hired Nash as an architect. He commissioned David Wilkie. He, you know, he championed Edmund Kean in the theater. You know, you can't be, in my view, you can't be all bad if you read Jane Austen's novels again and again and think she's a major novelist long before we came to that realization ourselves.
Well, you know, let's follow the track of the arts for a little bit, because those are wonderful chapters in this book. But the differences in society that existed at that time are brought into high relief by two artists that you talk about, John Thomas Smith and Thomas Lawrence.
Yeah.
And I was not familiar with the prints of John Thomas Smith, and I Googled them immediately after the few examples in your book. And what an astounding collection that is.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's one of the things that makes that book really interesting is called Vagabondiana, and it's 1817. And Smith knows Constable, and he also knows William Blake, who, of course, you know, is an artist, a major artist and a major poet at the in the period, although we didn't realize that till the 20th century. But Smith castigates these poor people in the streets of London in his text, but then in the images, some of which are in the book, it's very clear that he feels great sympathy and compassion for these people.
Absolutely.
And these are the people that don't make it into Jane Austen. These are the people, you know, and there are tens of thousands of them, hundreds of thousands of them. These are the people that protest at Peterloo. These are the people that the political system is just not even.
It reminded me of during the Victorian period, the London Labour and London Poor. By Mayhew, that same kind of real attention to detail to how the people were struggling at the lower end of the economic ladder.
That's right. And you would never, if you read Jane Austen, you would never come across these people. And Smith brings them into high relief. And I had heard of Vagabondiana, but I had never sort of sat down and really studied it. And it is, it's a very, very, it's a sort of an aspect of the Regency that I really wanted to bring into view. I really wanted people to sort of leave Bath and London and, or at least walk into areas of London that maybe other Regency histories hadn't taken you into. And I wanted, you know, to show the dignity and the strength and the resilience of these people. These are people, you know, from different ethnicities, different places, and a lot of them are English, but they've just been left behind by a political system led by the regent that's just not interested in them. It doesn't believe that they should have a voice. It doesn't yet believe that there should be, you know, parliamentary representation for every person. And so I really was excited to get Smith and put him beside Lawrence.
And Lawrence is a classic example of the other end of the spectrum. Mm. And those are the paintings you're going to see hanging up in museums.
That's right. And Lawrence, and that's not to take anything away from Thomas Lawrence.
No.
Brilliant. Yeah, he's a brilliant. That's one of the things I really like about the period, that Lawrence is an exceptionally talented and innovative portrait painter who has given us images of that age, especially of women and the royal family, that are in galleries and that come to mind, that are on the covers of, you know, paperback versions of Jane Austen, for example. And he captures the character of these wealthy people, as indeed a little lower down the ladder does Jane Austen. But that's not, they're not the only people that were there. They're not even the only people who were living in London. And I really wanted to write a history in which, you know, people who had maybe been left to one side were brought more clearly onto stage.
And I think you do that brilliantly in this book. While we're still in the arts, we have to mention Constable and Turner, because these are two of the greatest artists. I mean, and a list of some of the great painters in the world, you're going to find Constable and Turner. Constable literally creates the image of the British countryside that we still think of when I, especially if you're not from Britain, that's the image that you have.
Yeah, and I wanted to point out that Austen is writing her novels when Constable is producing his paintings, and you know what's happening that kind of artistry, that kind of innovation. I try to talk about this a little bit at the end. You know, how do you galvanize creative minds in that way? And Constable's image of rural Britain is still the image that is very attractive today. Those paintings capture something about the British countryside that's not been bested in 200 years.
And people still use the phrase Constable Sky. It's a real Constable Sky. Turner's a different story entirely. I'm always fascinated by Turner's works.
Well, one of my favorite sections is when I thought, okay, well, Turner and Constable, you know, it's like Lennon and McCartney or something. You know, they go together. So you know, then you start thinking, okay, well, what made Turner and Constable different? What did they do that was different? And one of my favorite sections of the book is where I try to explain, you know, what Turner would have seen if he looked at it, and what Constable would have seen if he looked at that sky. And of course, there's some overlap, and there's some, you know, there's some borrowing. But Turner's ability as a prodigy, his talent at six is just staggering, and he becomes, you know, a full a member of the Royal Academy very, very early on, whereas Constable struggles and struggles and struggles, and finally in 1819 he becomes an associate member, and he says, you know, my struggle to become an associate member is the equivalent of Waterloo. I just didn't ever think I was going to make it there. And so there's this wonderful moment when Turner and Constable sit down at the same table, and Constable writes to his wife Maria and says, I found in Turner what I always expected to find, which is a wonderful range of mind. So putting those two side by side and saying really they are the major figures in British art in the 19th century, certainly, and I would say well beyond that, and recognizing what they did to transform painting at that moment was an exciting part of the research for this book, for sure, for me.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer and historian Robert Morrison. He is the Queen's National Scholar at Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, and we're talking about his latest book, The Regency Years, during which Jane Austen writes, Napoleon fights, Byron makes love, and Britain becomes modern. Rob, why don't we talk about the novel for a bit? I mean, again, we could talk at any one chapter for an hour. The novel was really, and this is a quote from you, was really at the heart of the Regency culture. But it's interesting. People early on were conflicted about the effect that novels had, especially on women.
Yes, well, the novel was new. That's what it's got. You know, the Greeks wrote poetry, and the Greeks wrote drama, but there's this upstart new sort of comer on the block, and that's the novel. And if we date the British novel, we usually go, you know, to the beginning of the 18th century with people like Daniel Defoe, and afterwards Henry Fielding, Samuel Richardson, people like that. And it's looked at as sort of a rather dodgy, you know, cultural development. And by the end of the 18th century, especially after the rise of the Gothic novel in the 60s, it's, you know, they're salacious and they're thought to undermine morals pretty badly and pretty quickly. It's sort of vaguely like, you know, the advent of rock and roll in the 1950s.
That's right. It's or like what, comics, you know, in the comic books in the 50s, yeah, that were thought to rot your brain and lead you into sin.
That's right. And so, you know, if you read novels, you know, who knows what's going to happen. And so, in the Regency, what happened? The major figure is Walter Scott, who right. in 1814 publishes a historical novel, what's considered the first historical novel, called Waverley. And Scott shows what you can do with a novel. And now, of course, the novel, I would say, is our major cultural form. If you want to talk about what the world looks like in 2019. I would say the most expressive medium, that is more than film, more than drama, more than music, I would say the most expressive medium is the novel. So it's gone from, you know, disreputable to really what I would say the major art form of our era, and it's been that for a long while. That's not necessarily the case, right? In Shakespeare's day, it wasn't the novel. There weren't novels. It was the play. So Walter Scott shows the world, really, because he becomes internationally famous, what you can do with a novel, what you can do with character development, what you can do with plot, how you can bring out, you know, dialect, history, and complexity and sophistication in a novel. And the Waverley novels are the great runaway success, publishing success of the Regency. And even now, if you go to Britain into a secondhand bookshop, you're going to feel it creaking under the weight of different editions of the Waverley novel. Scott is one of those writers who was enormously popular at the time. And there's a resurgence of interest in him, and he is a magnificent writer, but he'll never get back to where he was, you know, in terms of reputation 200 years ago. So he reclaims it. One of the things he does is he reclaims it for men. It all of a sudden becomes okay for men to read the novel, because instead of it being about romance and domesticity and you know, young women getting chased by evil men through forests, it becomes about history and about action and about valor and about bravery. And so Scott reclaims it for this sort of, he masculinizes it in a way that reclaims it it makes it okay for men to read it. Not that men weren't reading novels before, but it was primarily a form that had, you know, that they'd sort of turned their noses up at. So Scott clears the way, and then people like Austin.
Well, can we stop at Austin for a second? Because you're writing about how the audience during the Regency thought about Austin's novels. I found really interesting because if I remember right, you talk about how they just really appreciated the ordinariness of her versus these torrid, like sort of weird things that were being passed off as novels. They just loved the fact it was like normal stuff happening.
Yeah, of course, now we read it and think, oh my, that's a world that's far, far removed. Walter Scott was a great novelist, but he was also a great literary critic. There's lots of great novelists who are terrible literary critics. So Wordsworth was a great poet, but he's not a great literary critic in my view. Whereas Scott was a great novelist and a great literary critic, and he knew, like the Regent knew, what Austen was accomplishing in her novels. And Scott is the one who said, you know, she's really showing us ordinary life. Now, ordinary life for the people in an Austen novel. It wasn't ordinary for lots of other people in Britain, including the ones that are in Smith's images. But Austen doesn't have, you know, dramatic event. I mean, what makes Pride and Prejudice, in my view, one of the many things that makes it so marvelous is that I don't know how many times I've read that novel, and I don't know how many times I've taught that novel, and I'm not even going to guess how many essays I've marked on that novel. And yet, when I read that novel, I'm like turning the pages quickly. Like, what's going to happen? It's like going to Romeo and Juliet and thinking, you know, I hope something better happens this time at the end. And then, of course, it doesn't. Well, in Pride and Prejudice, it ends happily, as we all know. But Austen, as Scott recognized, has this ability to make pretty ordinary events absolutely spellbinding. And it's because it's a number of reasons, but one of them, I think, is that she just so deeply believes in her characters and in their emotions and in their desire to live a full life. And for example, Elizabeth Bennet, you know, we get terribly, like, if Darcy doesn't show up and if he doesn't start behaving better, that is a problem. she's got us very interested in what happens to those five sisters in Pride and Prejudice. And it's not action-packed. You know, there aren't torrid love scenes in Jane Austen. What makes Austen so effective is that it's a glance across the room. You know, he touched her hand. It's that kind of understatement that gives the novel right. such energy. She's a master at sort of making us wait and wonder and hope, just like her novel, just like Elizabeth Bennet is waiting and wondering and hoping.
For me, though, the novel of the Regency has got to be Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And you write a lot about Mary Shelley and Frankenstein and its relationship to the tenor of the times.
Yeah. About 3 years ago, I taught a course on early 19th century British literature, and I thought, I can't do Frankenstein again. I mean, I've just done Frankenstein every year for 25 years. I'm going to, you know, the students always really like it, but I'm going to give myself a break, and I'm not going to do Frankenstein. Well, I spent 8 months going, you know, it's like it is in Mary Shelley's, I'm not doing that novel. You can't, in other, what I'm trying to say is you can't really sit down to talk about the beginning of the 19th century without talking about Frankenstein. And the number of times I got to a topic in the Regency years, and I thought, oh, you know what? I could bring in Mary Shelley. Mary Shelley talks about that in a really interesting way. And then I went back and thought, oh my goodness, I'm writing a book about Frankenstein. I better start trimming this back. You know, she is a teenager when she starts that book. And I say at the end that it is the most obvious prophecy of the modern age right. that was written. And it just anticipates so much of what has happened in science, in medicine, in, you know, personal relationships. It works on so many different levels that it's a hard book to get around. It's certainly the most famous book of the Regency, Frankenstein, 1818. Yeah.
What's amazing to me about it is that there's also this sort of undertone of a lot of the issues that are going on in the Regency mm-hmm. that you write about. The coming of the industrial development and this sort yeah. of industry versus what had gone on before. And then, you know, all the other things that went on. And there's that undercurrent in Frankenstein that's about that, about how people are changing their attitudes and thinking about, like, vitalism and so many of the issues of the day.
Yeah, well, Frankenstein, before Frankenstein, we think that creation comes from God. And after Frankenstein, Mary Shelley says, well, you know, humankind has godlike abilities. We can create, we can imagine, we can bring into being things that weren't there in poems or novels. There's this massive creation going on in art or right. in the Industrial Revolution. All these strange creatures are coming into being, whether it's a steam engine or some kind of computer or a sky that Constable paints that nobody's ever seen before, but nobody can forget. And so the Regency, to a very considerable extent, is all about creation, and Frankenstein is all about creation. And Victor Frankenstein, and I always say to my students, listen to that first name. She didn't call him Victor by accident. She called him Victor because in some ways that's how she thought of him. He is a brilliant man and a terrible dad. That's Victor's. He's terrible. His child, his creation is born. He struggles for a long time to get it to happen. And when this person, depending on how you frame it, this person, this creature, this being comes to life, the first thing Victor does is run away
right.
and abandon him.
Right.
And if you abandon a child, I think it's pretty safe to say that it's probable that bad things are going to happen. And bad things happen. And Victor won't take responsibility. And, you know, humankind brings things into the world, whether it's the atom bomb or whatever it is, and we don't necessarily take care of it, or we don't necessarily take care of others, and things unravel. And that's a parable for the modern world, for sure.
We only have a few minutes left. What I want to end with is, and you address this in the book too, is how did the later Victorians look back on the Regency period?
Well, William Makepeace Thackeray wrote the great Regency novel, which is called Vanity Fair, 1847-48. Thackeray looked back and said, I can't believe that anybody for a minute tolerated that guy on the throne. He was an appalling human being. And so Victoria, you can configure Victoria's reign, which is 1837 to 1901, she's on the throne for a long time, as doing damage control for the disrepute that the regent brought the monarchy into. But I think, and I try to bring out in the book, that's a little unfair. There are all kinds of things that happen in the Regency, including the defeat of Napoleon, and I would say also the flourishing of the arts, that would not have happened without the regent's enthusiastic support. And so I try to give a more balanced view. The Victorians, you know, turned away in moral revulsion. But I think that I tried to present a more balanced view.
Was there a time period where suddenly people started to look back and take a more nuanced view? Did it take into the 20th century for that to happen?
Into the 20th century, yeah. Royal apologists were pretty quick to, try to rehabilitate him. But he's responsible for, like, Regent's Park and Regent Street in London and the Brighton Pavilion. And, you know, the people who were hungry in his age have, of course, long since passed away. But if you go visit the Brighton Pavilion on the southern coast of England and you see this soaring, unbelievable building, admiration for me creeps in.
That's right.
I don't want those people hungry, but this astonishing architectural structure is the most potent symbol of the imagination and the vision of this monarch who wanted Britain, who recognized that Britain was the most powerful country in the world and wanted that recognized, not just politically, but wanted it recognized in terms of the arts and imaginative creation.
We're going to have to end it there. My guest tonight has been writer and historian Robert Morrison. He is the Queen's National Scholar at Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. And we've been talking about his latest book, The Regency Years, during which Jane Austen writes, Napoleon fights, Byron makes love, and Britain becomes modern. Rob, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.